they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole.
Get we found ready. It's time again to venture down the rabbit hole into the world of cybersecurity. You're plugged into the podcast for security leaders and practitioners with a business sense. Prepare for unique interviews, insights, and practical advice that makes your job just a bit easier. And now, please welcome your guides on this adventure, James Jardine and the White Rabbit, Ruffalos.
All right, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome down the Security Rabbit Hole to yet another awesome edition of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Raph here, James there. What up, dude?
Hey, another day, another podcast. I'm looking forward
I love the new framing where your head is in the dead, well, was in the dead center of that bookcase. And you've got all kinds of symbolism and imagery around you. You got like the triangles, you got like books you've probably never read. You've got even got a globe there. I noticed it's not flat, so it's not accurate.
International. International, man. Like that. I got to represent. I actually need to go through a bunch of those books and get rid of them because they're super old. But yeah, there's plenty of books out there I haven't read. The one at the top, TCP/IP. Yeah, I've read a little bit of it. But
it's kind of funny. I wonder how many people can actually understand the fundamentals of TCP/IP, like handshakes and all that. I bet that's a lost art or becoming a lost art.
But listen, you're not asking Tuma if he's read every one of those books on the back of his, you know, law library. Nobody reads all those things.
I bet he has. That's the thing about Tuma. I bet he has. All right, let's get on with this. So returning guest, Mr. Ira Winkler. Hey, buddy, how are you?
Great. How are you? Well, you know, you're doing great. We spoke before, so we'll leave it at that.
we covered some interesting topics before we hit record. It turns out Ira gave himself away. He is, in fact, Batman because he's wearing the T-shirt. Although clearly he's we're all Deadpool fans.
I'm
here,
a Deadpool guy.
Yeah. So Ryan Reynolds, if you ever listen, if anybody ever knows you, get yourself on this show because that'd be just awesome. We'll pretend to talk cyber, but no, we won't. We'll talk about Deadpool anyway. All right, that'd be a great interview, wouldn't it? All right, moving along, yeah. Ira, your expertise is in the human element of the threat equation. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you're working on now, and then we'll, I guess, take it from there.
Well, mostly what I've been working lately on is refining what I'm calling human security engineering. And what human security engineering involves is everybody loves to talk about the stupid user. I despise the term the human firewall. I despise the user as the last line of defense. If your user is the last line of defense, you have failed as a security professional. That's all I could say, because, I mean, just think of it this way. What happens just if the user happens to be malicious, which according to the Verizon data breach report are 28% of all incidents? If you are leaving your security program in the hands of a malicious person, you have failed. Because really, if you look at it, it's like adopting principles from outside of cybersecurity, because in the cybersecurity world, for some reason, we think we are like this special little snowflake. No, we're not like, you know, I mean, every profession out there has dealt with human error, or I don't even want to say human error, because error implies there's a mistake being made. Again, if it's malicious, it's not a mistake, but they deal with human actions, harmful human actions. And you're talking about fields like safety science. You're talking about fields like accounting. And all of these organizations say, hey, you know what? We realize we need people to do the job, and people are a critical part of our system. However, these people, in protecting and ensuring and securing the environment, their own safety or whatever, are going to, what I call, initiate a loss. You know, it might not be malicious, doesn't have to be, but if these people make a mistake or whatever the case is, they create systems in place that, frankly, proactively reduce the possibility or the scope of the mistakes or the error, the initiation of the loss. they then try to ideally guide the people in how they behave to make the right decisions. But then they expect them to make inevitably a wrong decision at some point in time, yeah. or I should say take a bad action, and they proactively plan for it. So, you know, using accounting as a concern, certain people, they take away privileges that don't need it. They put limitations on employees proactively. They filter out the types of accounting information different employees have. Then at the point of data entry, for example, they provide limited views that just allow the user to access or input or whatever the data they have. But then they also expect people to do the wrong things, and they might put limitations in place that say, okay, you're not allowed to do this without permission. Or in the worst case, they have, you know, accounting after the fact that tries to rationalize all of this and try to proactively detect failures. Now, in cybersecurity, that's exactly the situation we have, albeit in a different way. So when we're looking at this, again, without going off too much on the tangent, in cybersecurity, we need to adopt safety science, accounting, and other principles and say, okay, before, how or can we proactively limit the amount of information or the amount of access that people get? I mean, for example, if somebody sent a phishing message, if you filter out the phishing message, your user can't click on it. If you take the malware out of, if you take attachments away, they can't activate malware. Then if a user clicks on it, you can have nudges like warnings saying this might be bad. And then even if it's bad, you say, okay, you want to open that? Are you really sure you want to open it? Then the user says, yes, I do. Then you say, I'm sorry, you don't have admin privileges that allows you to download and install software. And then even if that happens, you have limitations on the system because a user, you know, if they click on ransomware, the user themselves is not going to encrypt every bit on the computer. The user is essentially just initiating the action, and the system has to allow the action to be accomplished. So put protections in place that limit that sort of stuff, whether it's anti-malware, data leak prevention, web content filters, whatever. You can stop all of these things, and this is just phishing as an example.
Yeah, so
anyway.
Nice, well summarized. Listen, we've long had this history in cybersecurity, InfoSec, enterprise security, whatever, of this, we'll say, mild dislike for the end user. If only we could get rid of the people part, right? Everything would be fine. I say that half jokingly because I think we've woken up in the last 10 years and realized that's a terrible idea and that doesn't work. Life doesn't work that way. But there was this push in the software industry about 10 years ago that essentially said, okay, we're not going to prevent people from doing bad things by accidentally, right? Let's look at the accidental part. We're not going to be able to prevent people from accidentally doing something bad, being fooled, being, you know, hoodwinked into clicking a link into doing this. But we can potentially prevent or minimize the damage they could do. Meanwhile, the other half of the other industry, the we'll call it the other faction, simply said, well, we just have to train them enough and they'll figure it out. I'll start with, and I'll get your thoughts on this, but I don't believe you can train somebody well enough. You can't give them enough security training on an everyday or once a quarter or once a year basis to get them through the fact that a well-funded, intelligent attacker beats just about everybody, including some of my cybersecurity colleagues. Your thoughts?
Yeah. My thoughts are, this is exactly why, again, I use the concept of user-initiated loss. This is what my book, You Can Stop Stoop, is about. Stupid, by the way, is not the stupid user. Stupid is the stupid security professional who presents attacks into the hands of the users or gives users the ability to create lots of damage or potentially goes ahead and then allows the user to do something. And then knowing a user is fallible, in one way, sorry, my dog wants to join.
That's okay. We allow dogs anyway. On the podcast. That's pretty cool.
Well, you've got your rabbit in the background. I have the dumbest border collie you could ever possibly meet. He relies on his looks. But anyway,
oh my.
So anyway, what happens is, so you can never rely upon a user to ever do the right things. Because even if you assume this, statistically, a user will fail 4% of the time, according to the data breach reports and everything else of the people who compile the statistics. The fact of the matter, though, is that technology fails, even a bad anti-malware system will fail 0.01% of the time. So users are your least reliable link on average, just for errors alone. And to rely upon this, but the problem is, and this is why the concept of the human firewall is such a problem. Saying you're going to create the human firewall is creating an expectation. It's creating a false expectation that is completely undeliverable. But what you as a security, I help with security awareness programs. I'm not selling the human firewall. I'm selling risk reduction. I'm saying, look, even if we take user error from let's say 5% down to 4%, we're reducing 20% of the actual incidents. And for those 4% of people to fail anyway, your technology had to fail in the first place to give them the attack. And simultaneously, my job is not, like I spoke, what am I doing? I'm not just implementing the awareness program. I'm sitting there and saying, okay, we're going to take it from 5% down to 4%, reducing your risk by 20%. Now, let's figure out what that 4% can do and what controls can we proactively put in place to expect that. And more important, they can only do they might download the ransomware from hell, but what about the malicious people? What about those other people? What else can we do to proactively determine what damage they intend to do and start putting limitations around them? Because, you hear a lot of awareness professionals who want to empower the user. You don't want to empower the user. You want to give the user the ability to do the jobs they need to do. You don't want to give them way more than they would ever. You don't want to give them more capability than they need. You don't want to give them more credit than they deserve. You want to give them the abilities that they need to do their job on a daily basis, consistently and reliably, and expect they will fail. And what I mean by they have the potential to initiate loss and then predict what is that loss they can initiate. And then you mitigate that both proactively, in other words, take the capability potentially away by, for example, weeding out anti-malware proactively or reactively saying, hey, they can give out credentials, they can send information to the wrong places. How do I limit that?
So
sorry, I'll get off my soapbox.
Yeah, right. So that said, Ira, it's interesting because there's an entire field of vendors around, if we can just, we need to train people to be secure. We just need to train them more. We just need to do more awareness as if people really aren't aware that there are bad things going on. But it seems like we've tried this, and I'm not knocking anybody because Lord knows, this is a hard problem to solve, but we have been trying to just educate the user, much like educate the developer. I'm doing air quotes for those of you not watching the video, for a very long time, to basically the same degree of success, which is low. What's the missing piece here? Because at some point you can't just go, well, they're never going to figure it out, so let's forget that. Let's not try. I don't want to do that.
The missing piece is the acknowledgement that all security professionals are not security professionals. We are risk managers. And we have to call out snake oil where it's called out. And some people have good products that they are selling as snake oil. Creating the human firewall, that's a snake oil sales pitch. conquering era, snake oil sales pitch. It doesn't mean the products are bad. It means that they are selling to a naive customer base, because I'm not telling people I'm creating the human firewall. I'm telling people, look, I am reducing the risk that you are creating by giving users first things they shouldn't be given, and simultaneously not expecting or not mitigating what they will be given. And by going ahead and saying, look, you have good products out there. Frankly, I'm more of a fan of those product suites that go ahead and, for example, without going too specific, well, it is specific, but I'm not affiliated with these, but companies like Mimecast and Proofpoint.
Yeah.
What they do is they take the phishing problem and integrate the problem together. They have the proactive mitigation of attacks reaching a user. They have then, like they're now implementing, both companies are implementing the ability to take actual phishing messages, de-weaponizing them, and push that into phishing simulations. And what that does is that goes ahead and actually trains people on real attacks. Now, the thing is, phishing simulations, I think a lot of people, if you rely upon them as your awareness program, you're a failure as an awareness professional. However, by sending people these phishing messages, it does have an impact. I just worked with people on a NIST-funded research study, and we found it was like where we gave people psychological tests and then sent them phishing messages and determined what were psychological types that made people more or less susceptible to phishing attacks.
Okay.
And one example was somebody, and I'll give you the positive. The negative is people with, the negative, just for proactive, is people, frankly, who have neuroticism tendencies, people with depressive tendencies, people with low self-image. They were more susceptible to phishing attacks. People who had low locus of control, people, in other words, who don't think they have control of the environment around them, were more susceptible. On a good note, people with self-discipline, if they were hit by one phishing message, they were significantly less likely not to be hit by a second phishing message or not to be tricked by a second one. And so these type of phishing simulations, when you catch somebody, it does help trigger them not to be caught in the future. It makes them a little bit more aware. You know, how long that lasts is another impact, but that's a benefit.
Yeah.
And now, on the other hand, saying that creates the human firewall is snake oil. Saying it reduces your risk is accurate. Saying we can reduce your risk significantly, 20% is significant, and I would bless something like that. Saying you're going to create a firewall, regular firewall stuff. Why do you want a human firewall? But either way, it's a risk reduction strategy. And security awareness people are out there, because the security awareness, I mean, a lot of technical people snicker at the concept because, you'll always have a stupid user. You can't stop stupid. Remember, my book is You Can Stop Stupid. And the stupid is actually the people saying you can't stop stupid, the actual people saying it. But the reality is you need to proactively say people are going to fail. People are going to initiate a loss of some form. My job as a security professional, and the definition of security is being free from risk, so you will always be a failure. Your job is, however, to reduce risk in a cost-effective way. And that, you can do that with these tools.
That right there is a flashpoint for me whenever I hear that. Okay. This notion, and this is perfectly salient to today's outside of InfoSec world of virology and all sorts of things. If you're looking for a risk reduction to zero, you're going to have a bad time. The end.
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody is guaranteeing security. If a CISO walks into place and says, I'm here, we will never have an incident, that CISO, frankly, should be walked out the door, because odds are in any company of any significant size, there's an incident occurring at that very moment. you know, you will always have some form of incidence inside, whether it's something as simple as a lost USB drive, whether it's somebody accidentally hitting the wrong click, entering the wrong, autofilling the wrong Michael on an outgoing email message, or whatever the case may be, there will always be a problem. And by selling a concept like a, you know, the concept of a human firewall that you will never have a security related incident is a fundamental flaw, because when, if you go to somebody and say, I'm creating this, nobody's got, you know, nobody would, you know, I always say, and I've said this long before I ever did awareness, the only people who ever sell you perfect security are fools, liars, or a combination of both.
And our industry is no, has no shortage of those, Ira.
Oh, I'm well aware of that. But, you know, nobody can sell you perfect security. Nobody can sell you, my advice will always work. You know, we will create this firewall where no user will ever make an error. All users will behave completely aware. You know, you're, and because the first time something happens, it's like, hey, where's that person that told me they have the human firewall? I they're the first person I'm going to blame. You're the scapegoat. And by the way, you're fired too. But they're the easiest people to blame, or the CISO for acknowledge or accepting that as a goal. So, you know, the goal anybody – yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, so let me stop real quick, because I have a thought here, and James looks like he wants to throw something in as well. But I'll go first because it's my podcast. There seems to be this separation – fact. There seems to be this separation, and we haven't found a way to overcome this. And this maybe is my perspective, but of two camps of cybersecurity approaches. One is, and I hope this camp is dying off. I don't mean that literally. I mean just like shrinking. One approach is we can just block. We can, you know, the old line from crappy anti-malware tools, preventing all threats known and unknown. You're like, oh yeah, you make no sense. Good job. And then there's the so that, you know, we can prevent all the bad things that can hurt you. And then there's the what you just said, right? There's probably an incident going on right now. Assume breach, detect and respond, and pivot and limit blast radius and damage, and that's to go forward. Where do you put yourself in that camp? I think I know, but where do you put yourself?
Well, I definitely put myself in the fact that we're doing risk mitigation on a daily, you know, on a full-time basis. And so in definitely towards the latter camp. I'm not saying that you need to proactively, to the best of your ability, figure out where those bad people are. You need to go ahead and try to, I guess the phrase would be left a boom. You know, where you're looking to you stop the attack in progress and try to proactively stop it. In a good security program, you need a continuum of this. You have to, however, frankly, expect failure on the part of your security program. You know, I worked, I did a study for the Joint Chiefs of Staff back in, God, I'm really dating, 1994. Four or so, maybe 95, first study on defensive information warfare. General walks in the room, assistant, I think he was an assistant secretary of something or other. And it was like for the Secretary of Defense for policies and procedures, something like that. Walks in a room and he's like, here's the strategy. He's like, we need protection, detection, and reaction as a fundamental paradigm of defensive information warfare, which we now call cyber network defense. Because he's like, no, we need protection. Protection is a given, but protection will inevitably fail. So therefore, we need to detect where it fails so we can then rally the troops.
Wise man.
And go ahead and react in the appropriate place. But you will not tell me that defensive information warfare is just a matter of putting up controls and things like that, because that will fail. And that was way back 1995 for a smart person whose name I have completely forgotten. I actually found a copy of that report that I sold on eBay, I think. but I can't remember I don't think the general even had his name in the report. It was just the contractors who, you know, just the contracting firms, not even the individual contractors, with maybe an acknowledgement of who we spoke to. But anyway, sorry, that's, yeah.
So where does this breakdown happen? Because, I mean, I remember, you know, I mean, a decade ago, everything was push it, you know, endpoint security, antivirus, you know, you got anti-malware, we got all this stuff put on here. Is there some wall that gets hit where it's like, you know what, this all of a sudden gets too hard to handle. Let's just start throwing awareness at this thing and go a different tactic versus trying to say, okay, how do we get to those next steps that you're talking about of, okay, we've got this stuff, but there's more that we can be doing. I mean, how many people are actually going to sit down and say, you know what, those people don't need attachments. Let's take that off their plate. You know, and that versus saying, you know what, instead of doing that, let's just teach everybody about security and, you know, hope that, you know, we'll call them that last layer of defense, and it saves us from actually having to go through and find out technical capabilities to do this.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't have, everybody thinks I hate awareness. I don't hate awareness. I hate the way people rely upon awareness. I hate the false promises people make of awareness. But to your comment, there's a continuum. You have to have everything. I know that sounds, you know, like a lot, but you have to expect the failure. You have to look for good proactive measures. You know, regarding the user, however, the user doesn't encrypt the file. Saying you're going to rely on your users, it's like, no, the operating system encrypts the files. You have an application that runs on the operating system, but the operating system still enables this. And you have to look at, again, layered approaches. You know, sometimes, like to a certain extent, a good zero trust environment can actually start to weed away a lot of these problems. You know, it's not a perfect environment, but it is an environment by creating an environment, for example, where, you know, like, for example, Zscaler has a private cloud environment that helps I think you have to purchase, I don't know the product detail, but you might have to purchase different elements to weed out all the attacks. But there are things in place that can help, again, in the concept is risk reduction. Filter out these attacks. Go ahead, work with, for example, the cloud providers and email providers who can filter out these things better than you can on a regular basis. Add secure tunneling and things like that to take away, or SSL TLS inspection that inspects links and things like that that might go to a theoretically safe Google Drive site, which is actually there to just download malware onto the system.
All right, you need a
combination of all these things.
All right, you said it, so I'm gonna follow up on it. Zero trust. Zero trust. This is, you know, there's been a lot of buzzwords and a lot of catchy things, and we are certainly the mm-hmm. I don't know, the germinating bowl for buzzword bingo craziness. But I think zero trust is different. And I say that because it looks as if zero trust actually gives us some capabilities that even if everything breaks down, you don't have to worry about the intent is to limit the scope of the bad, the blast radius, if you will, when the bad thing eventually explodes, right? So isolation, high restrictions, least privilege, like these things are concepts that are not new, but we're finally implementing them. And this is one thing I'm actually excited about.
Yeah, I would agree. When you have both NSA and Microsoft both advocating for zero trust, there's something to it.
Yeah.
At the same time, there is... And here's the problem, given that it's a buzzword. It means everything and it means nothing. And the problem is that you have my goal wasn't to talk brands, but you have an organization like a Zscaler that pretty much created an infrastructure from scratch. You know, that created virtual cloud, virtual hooks into cloud environments and so on. Then you have other vendors who are essentially selling tools to implement pieces of zero trust. And, you know, they go ahead, well, we sell zero trust cloud access broker or something like that. And that is important, but that's not a full zero trust environment as an example. Right. You might have zero trust to a cloud environment, but have you implemented zero trust within your own organization subnet? And so you have it, but you don't. And this is why I think it's a good way to move, but we have to look at the implementation before we bless it. Much like, for example, I say awareness can be good. Phishing simulations can be helpful. But how you do it, if you just feed people crappy, you know, here's your UPS phishing message. Now we're going to have variety. Here's your DHL phishing message and so on. That's not going to help people because those type of messages don't even make it past the spam filters in real life. You need some more sophisticated phishing, which is why, for example, taking actual phishing messages detected in the wild and sending them through provide an air of more realism.
Yeah.
Likewise, so it's the implementation. Likewise, zero trust implementation is more than a buzzword, but it depends how you're implementing it to see how much impact you're going to have with it.
Yeah, it's kind of like everything else, right? The tool is great, and zero trust here is a tool. It's just a matter of how well it's implemented. And I got to tell you, you know, your point about falling for the same things. I have in the past month gotten some phishing that has gotten through the platforms that we leverage that I had to sit and stare at for a moment and go, this looks legit. Like, it's from the person I would expect. And then you have to kind of do the this looks like the right, the right reply to address. All right. This looks like the header's good. Huh. All right, right click, copy link, and ordinarily I'd submit it to something like URL query, but I've got other places now. But I've gone to that length where I've dissected the message, I've sent it out for URL analysis. Average person, not only do they not know how to do that, they have no interest. Like they're like, that looks okay. Let's see what happens. And I can't blame them.
No, you can't. I mean, I remember Amit Yaron when he was, when he was the cybersecurity czar, because we have had different flavors of cybersecurity czars. But I remember Amit Yaron when he was talking, I think, at a Black Hat of side event that I was at. And, he was saying, it's like, yeah, I've actually seen some spear phishing attacks that have gone to defense contractor executives. And I'm looking at these messages thinking, I would have clicked on that because China and other people are, I don't want to mention China or Russia as big bad people. Frankly, they are nation states and they have an implied obligation to improve their own defense. It's a fact whether, if you want to mitigate that, that's one thing, but they have this implied necessity. And if they're going to target you, they are, depending on who you are, they're going to go beyond just clicking on a, here's your UPS message. There was just something going on around yesterday where Iran was setting up aerobics instructors from Scotland, hitting on defense contractors. And I'm like thinking, God, why are these people falling for it? Like a random aerobics instructor from Scotland is going to hit you up? Like, you're really that desperate? But they are.
Dude, they wouldn't do it if it didn't work. I'm just saying. Somebody asked me once, why do people bother sending out, 100,000 spam emails for whatever, not even malicious, but just for some product or placing ads for fraudulent stuff? And the answer is always the same, because it works, because people click on it, because people go through with it. They give out, they give their hard earned money or support or whatever. All right, hold on. We're about out of time and we can't end this on doom and gloom. Ira, give us something, close out with something positive.
My book, You Can't Stop Stupid, is awesome. And Security Awareness for Dummies is coming out next year. personally, I think that's awesome. On the other hand, though, a good note is, you know what, despite everything, you know, I'm not going to say we're in a great place, but we have a functioning system. Despite all these things going on, you know, we can have significant portions of the internet go down, be attacked or whatever, but yet somehow our economy is a functional economy based on this cesspool we call the internet. And somehow, I think if you're asking me to provide a good note, I mean, I'm here with you on the cesspool we call the internet. I don't know what that actually implies about this, but, you know, anyway, we have something that has really changed society, and I'll leave it for that.
All right.
Mostly for the better.
Oh man. All right. James, that was depressing. I'm trying to find the positive. But you know, look, James, I think the humans are always going to be the final step in the compromise, at least, or somewhere in that chain, right? Maybe less and less as everything goes completely digital and self-sufficient. But yeah, maybe Ron White was wrong. Maybe you can fix stupid.
I think, frankly, if nothing else, I tell security people, it is your job to fix stupid. Whether you want to accept it or not, whether you can fully accomplish it, at the end of the day, you know, your job is to fix stupid. And it's not to stop it from existing. Your job is to essentially, and if we're just implying stupid as the users, your job is to acknowledge your users are you're a fallible part of the system. And your job is to acknowledge it's fallible and how do you buffer around it and to mitigate
the
risk as cost effectively. So
that's right.
Anyway,
that's a great
now
place
my
to end.
Cat is
all right. On that, folks, we're going to end this episode. What's that?
Oh, I said now my cat has decided he might want to join the podcast. So
all right, before the rest of Ira's at-home petting zoo decides to get involved in the show, because once your cat gets involved, my rabbit's going to want to be involved in it. I think James might have some animals over there, and then this
my. So it's funny. My cat actually came in, meowing his face off. I had to send a message to my son, and I said, "Hey, can you come get the cat?"
this has been the podcast where the animals get to get in on it.
How far have we come that you know I have to send him an iMessage and be like, "Hey, can you come get the cat?"
Oh, all right. Folks,
and how far have
listening.
We come that this is not abnormal?
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. This has been another Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast episode with our friend Ira Winkler. And for James and myself, we'll see you another time, another place on yet another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Ciao, y'all.
As we fade out on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole episode, we'd like to encourage you to chat with our hosts and guests using the Twitter hashtag #DTSR. Please check out the show notes, catch up on any episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss a future episode. Our website is whiterabbit.net, whiterabbit.net. So on behalf of Rafal, James, for now it's goodbye. We'll see you soon on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast.